your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, May 22nd, 2025, as we record this new episode. The Chicago White Sox almost picked up another series win against the Seattle Mariners. After being down early 3-0 on Wednesday, the White Sox did storm back thanks to home runs from Tim Elko, Lenin Sosa, and Joshua Palacios. But they couldn't hold on as Seattle came from behind to win, and they took 2 out of 3 against the White Sox. In this episode, we'll recap that series, which featured new starting pitcher Adrian Hauser, and boy, did he make a great first impression. Let's revisit our chat about Joshua Palacios, who clearly heard what we had to say and had himself a series against Seattle. Chase Mydroth is on a tear. Tim Elko is taking Andrew Vaughn's reps at first base. And are we hitting the panic button again on Luis Robert Jr.? Plus a look ahead to this weekend series as the Texas Rangers visits, which becomes an old friend set with Will Venable managing against his former team and Jake Berger returns. Lots to chat about, so let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen. And to start recapping the Seattle Mariners series, Adrian Hauser, whirlwind of events, James. It seemed like he was in Chicago on Saturday. We got a tip that he was going to be signing with the White Sox. We were waiting for confirmation. Hauser officially didn't sign with the White Sox until Tuesday afternoon. He starts that night, and he goes 6 scoreless innings on 90 pitches. He did walk 3 and only struck out 2, but he only allowed 2 hits. That's a great first impression for Hauser with the White Sox. So what's the plan for Hauser, and what does this mean for Bryce Wilson, James?
I mean, he's in the rotation. Should add on top of craziness, Adrian's like wife is very pregnant, like too pregnant to travel with him on top of all the things he's kind of dealing with whirlwind-wise. He had a May 15th opt-out of his Rangers contract. He had like a really good start the day before and been kind of pitching well his last 2-3 outings, like good Cisco lines against him. After like a couple games earlier in the season where he like didn't get out of like his first inning of work. I think one time he's working relief, but the other one was just a clunker. And he had started trending up to where his agents, like, we should at least like trigger our opt-out and see what's happening. And the White Sox were on it right away because Bryce Wilson's been struggling. Gave him a guaranteed deal. And everyone has said, like, he's basically in the rotation from here on out. Obviously, he underperforms. $1.35 million, probably a prorated version of it. It's not, like, the biggest commitment in the world. I don't think they just, like, ride him through, like, a 10 ERA or anything. But they signed him to a major league deal. They're not handing those out like candy. And, you know, he's brought in to be a starter. He's been stretched out. He, like, pitched, like, almost a complete game his last Triple-A outing. He's in the rotation. Wilson, you know, we talked to him. I guess Wednesday, Thursday. Anyway, we talked to him this week about after the move happened. You know, he's kind of very, you know, self-aware about it. Like, I didn't perform well enough. They had to do something. I get it. And going back kind of a swingman role, I think he'd be another case. Like, if someone went down, I think they know a little bit about like how the starting thing went. And, you know, he kind of needs to prove himself a little bit on that. He's doing this move to switch more third base side of the rubber. He had already kind of lowered his arm slot and he thought like, well, I shouldn't like double up on this. And so he moved more first base side of the rubber because he felt like he was already kind of far out with his new slot. Now he's just going to go crazy far out and we'll see how that plays out of the bullpen. And hopefully it's good. And I still think like if an injury pops up, if they, something happens kind of on short notice, someone like needs to be scratched, Wilson's kind of the first option to, be kind of the fill-in starter, spot starter, long guy. That said, if he's still struggling, I think there's, you know, Clevinger hasn't really distinguished himself in any way, but
no,
I still think he's kind of the first,
that idea right now down. No,
the first at least temporary option, even if maybe you have a bit of a sample where if like it's another Martin Perez level absence, I don't think I'd necessarily stick with Wilson for months on end, unless he has a big trend up with what he's doing adjustment wise. But Hauser looks good. He worked at the same offseason facility as Davis Martin in Oklahoma City. It's also where Jackson Jobe trains, and he has like this whole mechanical change where they moved his arms farther out, and that gives him a bit more balance. He's able to sit in his back leg. A lot of fancy stuff, but like he's throwing, 1 to 2 mile an hour harder with the sinker, and he didn't strike anybody out, but got a lot of ground balls. Most statistical models, they have a lot of stuff that goes into stuff components, but generally, if you throw the stuff harder, your pitches work better. And that seems like what's the case with him. And there have been flashes where he's been kind of a good innings eating back end starter for stretches, at least in his career. So they're hoping if he's ticked up, that that's what it'll be, and kind of ride with it for a little bit.
Yeah, tough situation though, personally. Like having to leave your wife behind. I guess you're chasing a bigger paycheck. I wish everyone the best. I'm sure when that does happen and Baby Hauser comes into the world, that Adrian may need a few days off from the White Sox to celebrate that. And we hope the best for his family.
Yeah, I was looking
Tough
it up on
situation.
his Instagram just to see if he had a kid before, and they do have one kid, second one on the way, but sometimes with
Okay.
second ones, sometimes you're like, yeah, it's not that big a deal. Go find yourself that better job.
He's very like, ask him like, why'd you come here? He's like, hey, I didn't have a major league starting job before, and now I do. Didn't know when the next opportunity is coming. We'll sleep in at this one. So.
Both are time crunches. You can't really extend the timeline or put on delay. So yeah, it is a conversation. But yeah, I was curious if it was the first one or second one, because first one, it's a case of, yes, a lot of times it's like, I need to be there. I don't know anything about this. What's going to happen? If you get one under your belt, it might be a case of easier to relax, know how it goes, have a support system, and be able to kind of pursue that career goal with like less. Yeah, less weight on your brain, because you've done it before.
Yeah, and hopefully there's that what dad strength with major leaguers, especially hitters, when they become dads again, they always have like a big game and everyone says that's new dad strength. Maybe
Yeah.
that will happen for the White Sox with Adrian Hauser. What did you think about Hauser and his first start with the White Sox, Jim?
Good. I mean, as advertised, pretty straightforward in terms of like sinker forward and getting ground balls and not getting a ton of strikeouts, but I guess the pleasant surprise was that he had a wider array of secondaries than either he normally does or that I appreciated when it came to his profile, like being able to lot of variety with the breaking balls, change-ups, to where like sometimes the sinker ballers, they get their lineup once or even twice, and it's like, okay, they throw a sinker, big deal. Once the velocity is down, and they start missing higher, it's launch time. But in this case, it was very much a being able to sequence differently, seem pretty relaxed in terms of like the game plan with Edgar Caro. Like there was a lot to like for somebody who just signed a deal the day of. And I guess what he's making, I think, like $35,000 at least prorated more than Bryce Wilson is. Or is it 300? It might be 300. I think Wilson's 1.05. So yeah, that would be 300. But either way, like it just like, when it comes to the pecking order of White Sox guaranteed contracts, he did sneak in one peg higher. And so I guess he does have this job for the time being.
Wilson did say, like, finally, like, damn, I've never seen him have a curveball quite like that, like before. So, like,
Okay. So I'm not
yeah.
the only one surprised.
And Hauser said, like, he felt like the adjustment that, had knock-on effects for all his secondaries, that he felt like he was getting to him easier. So, yeah, I think that scans.
Well, Hauser's next projected start for the White Sox will be in Queens against the New York Mets. That'll be a very tough test, but let's hope that the good vibes with Hauser joining the White Sox rotation continue. Over on the offensive side, so much focus on this because we have now entered the 50th game of the season. The White Sox are 15 and 35. So again, continuing to look for hope and looking for some hope on the offensive side. And boy, Jim, I think Joshua Palacios listened to our previous podcast episodes. Because he had a big series against Seattle, going 4 for 10 with power. He had two doubles and a home run in this series. And Jim, with this performance, and we know that Mike Tauchman and Andrew Benintendi eventually are going to rejoin the White Sox. It sounds like Tauchman's been with the White Sox. He's in Chicago for some time, so we're expecting some roster news. But with this type of series, did Joshua Palacios buy more time for himself in Chicago?
I don't know. I think is the fair answer, to be honest. I think in terms of his performance, he was due some regression. Like, he's a credible AAA hitter. He's had, stretches here and there of major league competency. So probably wasn't going to be as awful as he was. The quality of bats wasn't terrible. So to see him have a good series, while we were, while he's obviously a candidate to be like, where the hell does this guy come from and why is he taking so many prominent at bats? And why is he such a big part of the game plan? I think that was a bigger part of it than like this guy is a, has no business being in the majors. He has some business being in the majors for like a second division team. Like, he's played for the Nationals and the Pirates and the White Sox. Like, that's very much like the mode of team that he can find opportunities on. And so, he has that here. But when you look at the roster, just, with five outfielders on guaranteed deals, like, it's hard to find room for Palacios if Slater and Tauchman and Benintendi are healthy and Taylor's around and Robert's around and they're all there. Like, I don't know. You don't need six outfielders. And I guess the concern would be that if the White Sox designate him for assignment and Tauchman comes back or and he gets hurt immediately, which seems to have happened a couple times now, or Benintendi, same thing, like they've both been on the injury list multiple times. That all of a sudden you're like, oh, I wish we had Joshua Palacios. But I think, given his profile, there are a lot of him around. Like we talked about it last time, Dominic Fletcher would be another one of those Palacioses to integrate in the lineup and just cycle through to see if any of them click beyond like a 90 OPS plus. So, as nice as it was in terms of like bashing against the Mariners and an entertaining competitive series, which White Sox fans did not see against the Cubs. That a tip of the cap to him, and perhaps that sets him up well if he does get DFA'd for a team that is in the same position as the White Sox were in, that you need any kind of outfielder who can stand in major league batter's box, preferably from the left-handed side. He could be claimed and set himself up well for that next opportunity and the next cup of coffee. But this is, I think, was the drawback of Chris Getz's outfield fixation of just loading up on guys who are locked in, that should you find anybody that performs well enough for you, then it's really hard to make accommodations for him. So yeah, that's why I think Palacios probably out unless like there's a setback with rehab. Tauchman, I think he was 0 for 20 before he snapped a hitless streak. So Benintendi probably, or maybe he gets a game or two more. But it would seem like Palacios' time is limited, and so like, great for him to end it on a high note if this is how it ends. But given just the number of setbacks and such, or the number of injuries that have popped up, it could maybe not be even an outfielder. Maybe it's a case of infield, like or they say goodbye, Vinny Capra, and they just try to make it work for a couple of days until they make sure that Tauchman's healthy. But otherwise, I think if it's like a big picture move, I don't see how there's room for Palacios.
Got it.
To specify that Tauchman was in Chicago on Monday, seemingly like a little check-in, but then went back out to Charlotte with Venable saying that he needed to play back-to-back games in the field. He proceeded to play back-to-back games in right field and then wasn't in the lineup Thursday night. So hopefully you get to this listeners early in the morning so that there hasn't been like Tauchman's activated, Palacios DFA'd before you're even getting to enjoy the discussion about whether it should happen or not.
I guess you can interpret the discussion as should we miss Palacios if this feels like old news?
Press F to pay respect.
Palacios in 36 games. So Palacios already played 36 games with the White
That's a lot
Sox.
of games.
A lot of games, 100 plate appearances with the White Sox. His weighted runs created plus is now 91. WAR, according to Fangraphs, negative 0.3. But he had a big series against Seattle. We'll see if his roster spot is in jeopardy if the White Sox do officially call up Mike Tauchman this weekend against Texas. We'll preview that series later in the show. But while I was looking up Joshua Palacios and how this series against Seattle impacted his season numbers, I was a bit surprised in who leads the White Sox in weighted runs created plus, and that's Chase Mindroth. And Chase Mindroth is on a tear right now for the White Sox. He has a 9-game hitting streak. He also had a big series against Seattle. He went 5-for-12 against the Mariners with a double. He also picked up 3 stolen bases. And in 27 games this year, Mydroth has a 1.22 weighted runs created plus. That means he's 22% better than league average. He's already worth 1 WAR, according to Fangraphs. So there you go. White Sox position player reached 1 WAR in 2025. Huzzah! The White Sox actually have 3 hitters right now that carry a better than league average weighted runs created plus. Matt Theis is at 104. And Miguel Vargas, his strong May and winning player of the week honors last week, 102. Andrew Benintendi, when he returns, is at currently at 99, and Edgar Caro is at 94. We'll mention where Luis Robert and Andrew Vaughn are in a moment. But with Mydroth kind of on this tear, James, a 9-game hitting streak, he's batting over 300 now for the White Sox as a rookie. Is this sustainable, his level of play, or is this 2021 Nick Madrigal?
I'm glad you left that opening for a hot take by comparing him to 2021 Nick Madrigal, who I think everyone would say was below expectations in terms of defense, in terms of on-field decision-making, in terms of base running. The only thing that stopped 2020 Nick Madrigal from hitting was tearing his hamstring running the bases. Up until that point, he had hit. Up in 2020, he had hit. He has not hit since this major injury he suffered, which seemingly had knock-on effects with, you know, compensatory leg issues his following year with the Cubs. But I don't think Nick Madrigal hitting, someone who, sure, it's not a celebrated draft pick, but wasn't like someone who was projected to go in the second round the day he was drafted, or not viewed as having like an elite hit tool or elite feel for contact. I think, one, like, Madrigal's a small dude, baseball's hard, maybe injuries were kind of inevitable with him, but I don't think necessarily like him hitting was going to fall apart because of his skill set, you know, before he got mega hurt all the time. So in the same vein, like, Mydroth's been doing what he's been doing for a while. I think he's overperforming his XBA or X-Slug. He did that last year, too, in AAA. He was supposed to only, like, slug 320 based on batted ball metrics last season, and he slugged 400 in AAA. He's riding with, like, a 350-something BABIP right now. He does hit low-line drive contact very often, which closes his power ceiling, but is going to play well for getting hits and falling in. And his plate discipline has been excellent and really fueled like how consistently he's getting on base, give him kind of pretty high floor because he's not going to strike out very much and he is going to walk pretty often. And it's his first 100 plate appearances of his major league career where he presumably has clearance. I don't know if they need to file a waiver at the league office to get better while he continues acclimating to the major leagues. So sure, this is a heater right now. It's going to run hot and cold. It's going to dip, but I don't necessarily think like the bottom's going to fall out and he's going to be like a 70 WRCS player because everyone's going to realize he hasn't hit the ball hard. Something that's been kind of fun watching him is like, yeah, he's got the lowest chase rate in the league. He's been called passive in the past. He'll ambush balls early in the count. Like if you say like, oh, just throw fastballs to him, just pepper him with him because he can't hurt us because he can't slug, he won't lift in the air, probably. He did the other day weekend and Wrigley. Those seem like the sort of environments where he could, you know, hit some pull side homers, but he'll probably whip it for a single. He's been doing it the last 2-3 weeks. He's not just getting walks or racking up like these great chase numbers full of what I see as like full blown passivity. So yeah, I don't know if he's a 120 WRC plus guy from here on out. That'd be great. That would really solidify him, but I think it was already, I think like, even if we wondered like impact, even if it's enough of a bat to cover a few stretch defensively at shortstop or, you know, wouldn't necessarily make him an impact regular, I think I was pretty confident that he was going to be a guy who get on base. He's getting on base really well. So I think he's going to be certainly somebody who you feel pretty comfortable playing a prominent role in this White Sox offense for the next, this year and next, And you should only be so lucky if you get to a point where you're squeezing out Chase Meidrov, getting on base all the time because he doesn't hit enough power and the White Sox have so many better options. I feel like that day is a bit farther off. That's like asking Chris Getz when the rebuild's going to be done. Like, I don't think there's a date on it. So I think there's a pretty long runway for Chase Meidrov to do Chase Meidrov things the way it looks right now.
What surprises me is that like he's 8 for 8 in stolen bases. That I'm surprised to see him running as aggressively as he is. And looking at his record in the minors, like he could steal a base, but he struck me as one of those who was like more of like an opportunistic base stealer or somebody who might get a green light in situations where if you get thrown out, it's not that big of a deal, but has an above average chance of like making it on his own. In low leverage situations, but like he is running, especially given the amount of injuries he's recorded or the amount of nagging issues, like he's run the bases aggressively, tagging up aggressively, seems to be working out for him. But I think that's something that watching Madrigal play, that to me was the biggest disappointment for him, is just like how he didn't move the way he was supposed to move based on his Oregon State draft reports. Like that was supposed to be a big component, was like has an elite hit tool, may not get extra bases on his own, but can take extra bases with his legs. And so, like, he may not get doubles or triples, but he can get to second, go to from first to third, go from first to home. And, like, he got thrown out a lot trying to get that extra 90 feet. So, to see Meidroth doing that right now, running with abandon pretty much is a pleasant surprise.
If Meidroth keeps this up, he can be a two war or better player in his rookie year with the White Sox. I think that may surprise a lot of people. And that's a good early return for the White Sox and trading Garrett Crochet to the Boston Red Sox. Kyle Teal seems to be hitting better as well in Charlotte. He's getting going. Braden Montgomery is also hitting well. So this trade could be paying early dividends for the White Sox, especially with Chase Meidroth's play so far in 2025. Moving over to first base, Tim Elko hit another home run. And he is playing first base more than Andrew Vaughn recently. Elko's got 3 home runs on the season, but he went 1 for 10 against Seattle. In his first 10 games in the major leagues, Elko's batting 161 with a 188 on base percentage, but he's slugging 452. Andrew Vaughn went 3 for 11 against Seattle, all singles, and it's been 10 games since Andrew Vaughn has hit a home run, and he only has 2 home runs in the month of May. We're going to continue comparing Elko and Vaughn, Jim, just because they're on the roster at the same time. And you wrote about Vaughn's playing time. And now it's interesting that as of late, it's more Tim Elko defensively at first base and Andrew Vaughn. Is this the right move defensively for the White Sox? And how long do you think this arrangement lasts?
As somebody who first jokingly and then sincerely wanted to see more leaning Sosa at first base instead of Andrew Vaughn, because Sosa had some second base skills he was applying to first base in a pretty interesting way that, resulting in some range that we didn't see, whether it was Vaughn or Sheets out there, that, I mean, having Elko out there, it would be fun to watch in person, to be able to see it more. Like it's the watching it from home when you see the camera cut over and Elko's on top of a play that you don't necessarily expect Andrew Vaughn to be on top of, or Vaughn making a bigger show of it because it's maxing out more of his either range or his size. It's been a relief to see that kind of first base defense. So to me, like the couple flags were going through the game logs and like going through the defensive lineups and seeing Vaughn's name peter out over the course of May. There was the fact that Elko has started the last 5 games at first base, and that really seems like, well, if you're going to be a fringe hitter, at least we're going to get from you what you do well. And Elko has a reputation being a very good first baseman, double A, triple A. Like he's been a favorite of managers and coaching staffs and even like league honors for being a top defender at first base. And that's translated so far. But it really seems like in this case, like if you play good first base, then play first base. Andrew Vaughn does not play good first base. So let's get something good from one of these players, and then we'll hope that either with Elko that he's able to ambush the league, and in the case of Vaughn, like finally gets going. So that seems like sound decision making on the part of Venable. The part that I think jumped out to me was like seeing Vaughn come out of games during Venable's late game switches to maximize his defense when protecting a lead. Like, it was one thing to see, you know, Jake Amaya come in to you know, play shortstop, and then, you know, Brooks Baldwin or whoever going to the outfield to, you know, get Benintendi out of there. But to see Vaughn come out for Lenin Sosa, that was surprising to me in terms of like, oh, this is, he's not necessarily considered like the first string defender for the optimal run saving infield. And that's not something that has really been broached because of Gavin Sheets being the only alternative. And Sheets was not a good defensive first baseman himself. Also really hasn't been said, but if you look at like just the actions of Venable versus, you know, the rhetoric spoken around Andrew Vaughn, that's one of the keys to me that, okay, they're looking for ways to get value out of that position that they haven't been getting value at. And if it's a case where Vaughn has to sit or Vaughn has to be removed from the game, I think they prefer to do it like when Vaughn gets on base and then they can pinch run for him. And then you get the added wheels and then like you get somebody defending, but like they're just straight up replacing him defensively without the kind of offensive impetus to do so. That's, I think, I hesitate to make too much of it. And it's something that could be just, you know, should Talkman, Benintendi come back, Elko goes down, and then all of a sudden Vaughn is the default first baseman again, then perhaps this is all for naught. But I think the fact that Sosa got some late game appearances at first base, and you've seen Miguel Vargas even do a little bit of spot duty there, suggests that should Vaughn continue not to hit, that Venable and, you know, by extension, Chris Getz are more open to seeing either what else can you get from first base, or failing that, like, have you just given up on getting meaningful production from first base? And let's make it easier on the infielders throwing there and on the pitchers who are trying to get extra outs all the ways they can. And first base defense would be one of them.
Can Talkman play first base?
He hasn't. I'm surprised by that. Like, he, at least in recorded games, either minors and majors, been entirely outfield, which surprised me.
Okay. Because that was one idea, because you could technically send Elko down and Talkman could play first base, or I guess you could move Vargas over to first base if you want to give him some run there and have Rojas play third if you're adamant that Rojas must be in the lineup every day because he got that guaranteed contract. It'd be interesting this weekend, James, when we do get the roster announcement for the White Sox and how they handle this. But with Elko playing more defensively at first base than Andrew Vaughn, does that give Elko a little bit more staying power, at least for a couple of weeks, James?
Yeah, I would think. Probably not enough in terms of like to make him bulletproof. You know, what do you want out of a first? What qualities of a first baseman come to mind? Was it offense? Because I think someone who's like the team leader in hits, maybe that's someone you think of as a first baseman, which would of course be Lenin Sosa, as we all know. I think him being having options, you know, Sosa not, you know, Vaughn.
Vaughn's got options.
Yeah. It's probably like a nuclear option a little bit for them in terms of
three nuclear options.
I don't get it. Like, I'm going to be meatball for a moment. At this stage, we're 50 games into the season. Jim, you and I had an entire podcast episode laying out our case for optioning Andrew Vaughn. And Vaughn hasn't done a damn thing to change anyone's mind since we have had that podcast episode. If anything, he's further enhanced that case of why he should be in Charlotte right now. Like, I don't get it. Like, how far? He is the worst player in Major League Baseball. He's worth negative 1.3 war. Jim, he's going to challenge Adam Dunn. If you continue to play Andrew Vaughn as much as you are, and maybe not having to play defense saves on the war front, but we are talking about someone who is on pace to be worth negative 2.5 war this season. We have not seen that, for the White Sox at least, since Adam Dunn. And Adam Dunn had a physical ailment that he could blame that terrible season on. I don't know what Andrew Vaughn could blame this terrible season on.
Well, I mean, they would have gotten some guys 2.5 war if they didn't give up on him, like Martin Maldonado last year.
Sure.
Probably would have gotten there. Tim Anderson would have gotten there, perhaps, if he played a full season. But it's amazing how every year the White Sox have a new worst player in baseball, at least for the first couple months.
if you option him, even like if he doesn't accumulate any more service time, you're not paying his arbitration at the end of the year.
No.
You're, unless it's like a very quick refresh, it kind of takes you out of like any hope of like flipping him in a trade, even this like small scale one. It really kind of has to be, I feel like it'd be kind of the final decision. And I can't say he's not earned it. Like, even if there's underlying metrics that suggest he should be like more average, like it's 50 games. It's an ex he's an offensive only player, in terms of value. Like, he's not providing any, like, it wouldn't be out of the realm. It's just, it would require them making a, what I think has to be a final decision that they've kind of held off acknowledging is nearing in any way other than like what's recently kind of dribbled out of just his playing time indicating one level of dissatisfaction with like what he's doing. So I'd be not surprised in terms of like the merits there. I'd be surprised in like we didn't know when it was going to happen, if it was truly going to happen
Yeah.
until it happens type of level of surprise. I think the case is there. I think the fact that Elko is looking a little bit like you could make the case of, hey, he's a little overwhelmed, take that down, triple A, get refreshed, and you're chasing a bit. Let's focus on why it's happening and go mash on triple A, or go like, take this into your game prep with, eye pitch and stuff like that. I think because that safety valve is still kind of open to them, that's why I don't get quite the leaning it would happen immediately, but like, yeah. It's the first base like usage is laying bare, like all you're here to do is hit and you're
Right.
not hitting.
Yeah.
That can kind of bring the question to a forefront.
It's a case like him being DH is right now it's fine. Like nobody likes it, but it's fine just because when you look at who else could be taking those at bats if you don't want Matt Theis and Edgar Caro playing every day, which we've talked about it before here and there about Caro tending to just kind of hit a wall towards the end of the seasons. If you're managing his playing time and the stress of, adopting major league responsibilities that, they're not going to put him in DH when he's not catching every single game, then like Vaughn is your best bet for a good at bat and somebody who could theoretically get it going versus like Vinny Capra or something like that. So, when it's Benintendi's hurt and Talkman's hurt and Slater's just coming back, like there aren't a whole lot of better bets to take the DH when everybody else is handling defensive responsibilities. But I think this is the case when you have Talkman and Benintendi on the doorstep. Does he keep getting DH at bats? Is he the default first baseman? Do they start, meeting out his playing time, which, he's played basically every single game. So even like sitting him twice a week, playing him 5 out of 7 games, one series would feel like a major step down in terms of just drawing down his responsibilities. But yeah, it would seem weird to go from play we need you in the lineup every single day to enjoy Charlotte for the first time. And here's a TripAdvisor list of all our favorite places to do and see in the Queen City, which I don't think they're going to
He
do.
has been hurt before, so he's been on rehab
True,
some.
but
There's a
he's been in a
photo of him in
position
that
of.
Kooky Knights mask.
Oh yeah, it's a. I'm thinking of like the Gordon Beckham example. Like I remember Gordon Beckham talking about how he hadn't been in the minors in so long. He'd been there on like occasional rehab stints to where like, oh, I gotta buy these guys dinner because I'm making $3 million and everybody else is making $30,000, and so it's my responsibility to buy the spread while I'm here. But then like once he was back to being a full season player in AAA and minor league contracts, it's a case of like, nope, I'm one of you guys now. I can't, even though my career earnings are a lot higher, I'm just like anybody else trying to get back to the majors, and so that was an adjustment for him. And so I can see like it's, that among the many things, or many reasons like people knock Beckham for being like a. Yeah, maybe out of control when it comes to the broadcast booth, or maybe a little bit scatterbrained in terms of what he's saying. Like sometimes he has some really interesting recent player, especially recent struggling player experience that he brings into the broadcast booth. And that's one thing that stuck out to me was it's different coming back and just being there because you're struggling versus rehabbing.
It's 193 plate appearances, which is like one third of a typical season for Andrew Vaughn. It's a 44 weighted runs created plus. Andrew Vaughn is 56% below league average offensively. If Elko gets optioned for like Mike Tauchman, hypothetically, before this weekend series starts, and they keep Andrew Vaughn, I can't imagine what the reaction is going to be from White Sox fans on social media and the comments section on Sox Machine. I don't know. I think the case is pretty clear. Vaughn needs a reset. And even if that is a nuclear option, to James's point, you're not tendering him anyways after this season. You're not paying him $7, $8 million or whatever he could be asking for in his final year of arbitration. He will be a free agent after this season. And I don't think we
I
have to
mean,
worry about
like,
anyone trading for him.
although if he's in the minors long enough, then he would not reach free agent. That would delay his free agency.
He would get non-tendered,
Yeah, he
probably.
would get non-tendered, but in terms of like
He would find his way to free agency in some means,
it'd
whether
be a
where
case of
rain or
like
snow.
the clock is no longer the issue. It's a matter of talent. If
Yeah.
they send him down to the minors, like they would get that extra year of service time. They would not probably want that extra year of service time.
Someone that might be a free agent sooner than they were expecting, Luis Robert Jr. Luis Robert, this series against Seattle, 1-for-11. In his last 15 games, Robert is batting 170 with a 200 on base percentage and slugging 189. That's a 389 OPS in his last 15 games. Zero home runs, two walks to 14 strikeouts. Here's manager Will Venable speaking to where Robert is at.
For me, it's just as an observer, you see a guy that's got one mentality on the bases in the outfield and maybe and that's an aggressive one, and then maybe a little in between at the plate. And so for me, it's just about making sure that he felt supported and that at the same time that we're challenging him to do all the things that he needs to do to make adjustments to get better, and he's doing those things. So yeah, I think he knows where he's at. He's working extremely hard to make adjustments, and he's going to find what he needs to find to have more confidence at the plate.
James, you got a chance to speak with Robert earlier this week. How is he feeling about his struggles in 2025?
Not good. He seems quite frustrated. I think the general readership would probably not be happy how often my thoughts think back to like truisms that Frank Menachino was said to me. But if I was psychoanalyzing Robert, like answers, like he kind of got funny at points. Like obviously the line about like I don't think anyone wants me when asked about trades, or Bruce Levine went on this kind of funny line of questioning. He's like, hey, players back in the old days would just go out and get drunk and like come in, show up and get hits, like get themselves out of their mindset. And Robert like be like, yeah, I'm not really like that. And then like having this moment where he took it, he's like, maybe I need it though. I don't know. But and then realizing catching himself again, it's like, but I am not going to try that. Please put in the newspaper that I am not going to get drunk. Frank would often talk about like slumps and having like getting to the point where you're like frustrated and you're pressing. And then like the key is like getting to a point where you stop caring, so to speak, and not like in a stop showing up to work, but almost accept where you're at and like work through it and not like have no longer be held by the anxiety of like your numbers and stuff like that. And maybe like Robert's reaching this level of just like nihilism and beyond frustration with his slump that like he kind of gets out of his own head a little bit. But at this point, that's where everyone's at. Like the chase discipline numbers are better. I will still say like improved chase discipline for like Luis Robert still is a lot of chasing for like an average player, and he had points where he looks really awful against sliders off the edge of the zone, like in the Seattle series. I'm not sure, like it's been a biting theory that even at the end of last season they acknowledged a little bit, like I'm not sure like Robert chasing bet less is like a good Robert. I feel like maybe we haven't really seen that combined with like him being really good at capitalizing on mistakes in the zone, and maybe he's just someone who has to be super aggressive to be right. And I'm not, he's kind of expressed a little anxiety that like when he gets in this mode of really trying to discern and see pitches that he gets out of reacting and just kind of firing on good pitches that he sees. There was a point like he had like a game in Wrigley where he, I think he had like one hit out of it, but he had like four at bats and saw five pitches and kind of like, oh, maybe he's just gonna swing his way out of it and get in rhythm again. But yeah, it's concerning. I think you're at the same cutoff where it gets pretty hard to see how he's gonna have good numbers by the deadline. You still hope there's going to be like 3, 4 weeks of like looking like himself. But I think it's we're now getting to close to a full season or a calendar year since the last time you like looked good, and you don't really want to get far in that. It starts making like there's no physical reason he should be like cooked like this. Like his bat speed is still like near the top of the league. It's weird. Like his end zone whiff numbers haven't like exploded in some way where you think like he's off. Like he's asked about the knee injury and he said like that was no big deal as well. Like there's no reason it should be happening other than like it really feels like the situation doesn't suit him as far as like being the heart of a, like a lineup, being the guy everyone games plans for, and also trying to like be more conscientious about his approach. It really seems like a lot has been tacked on to what was an extremely lo-fi operation when he was at his best of like, what does he throw? How hard? All right, see you out there. And you know, being one of the better hitters on the team, I just think like, man, if he's like batting seventh on the Dodgers, he would just crush it. And I don't, I'm thinking more and more that that winds up being, or just like any team where he doesn't have to be the focal point, just kind of you know, provide, you know, they're happy with the baseline of value he provides with his defense and base running, and he just gets to clobber more mistakes whenever they come along. I'm just getting less and less confident that that's coming via major trade and more like, how do they acquire this tool out guy on the cheap? Well, he only just stunk for like a year straight, and the Sox had to cut bait because they didn't even want to pay a $2 million buyout, let alone a $20 million like club option. So they just took what they could get, which I think could be the case because it's just running out of time, and there's not some specific reason other than to just keep shaking him and saying, "Be yourself again, damn it." So it's going to be hard. He's not going to. I don't know if the offers are going to be the deadline. I kind of feel like they're in a situation where, like, especially with financially what they're facing, they're probably going to take what's best. And I don't know how good it can get, even if he starts tomorrow.
Another Trey Mago type deal. Quad Mago, the next Mago, the next evolution Magos. What's weird about watching Robert, we have a lot of experience. Having seen the other extended hitters, Yoan Moncada and Eloy Jimenez, kind of go through the same thing of just looking right briefly and then all of a sudden all comes undone. But like, this is the first prolonged stretch of somebody being ostensibly healthy that it can't be blamed on that, or you can't, with Moncada and Jimenez, even Robert in previous seasons, it was like the one wrong step running down first base that all of a sudden, like, 3 games of progress were completely unraveled, and you're hoping that that limp doesn't persist into another like 2 month stay on the injured list. But this is a case where like he's running fine, running with abandon. You can't blame that. And so I think it's a different level or voicing of frustration that we didn't hear with Moncada and Jimenez, even Tim Anderson, going back to him in his last year at the White Sox. Of just being miffed of why the lineup, the production isn't there, but ultimately knowing like the body failures of varying degrees were attributable to that. Like in this case, Robert seems fine, and even his sprint speed is within his normal range. Bat speed is ticking red in Statcast, so like everything's there. Just a matter of I was thinking. Spring training trades that him batting eighth on the Phillies would be feel like a coup for Dave Dombrowski. So just a shame that like the just it, I think when we've discussed Robert, I mean my fear was like it was always a case of like no matter when they trade him, it's always going to feel like selling low because he's never quite at peak value at a time that can be traded. And this would definitely be a case of like selling lower than low.
Or even when the White Sox after this weekend go on the road, the New York Mets, they might be a possibility as well. But I agree with you guys right now. We were contemplating a couple episodes ago, can the White Sox get a 45 future value grade prospect for Robert? Now it's like, can they get 240 guys?
Well, I think like with the future value thing, like they could get somebody else's Tanner McDougal. Like
They
he's got a
could.
45 grade, but relievers are weird. It would be a reliever. I think that in that case of just we got you the 45 FV prospect you wanted, but not the one you wanted.
even if he gets traded, unless he gets on an absolute tear for his new team, I don't think they're picking up that $20 million option.
Depends on the pockets.
Yeah, I guess I guess you're right, Jim. It does depend on the pockets, but I mean, we could be talking about a Robert entering free agency. Like everyone, Anderson, Makata, Eloy, then Robert, all free agents. Didn't get a chance to dip into the club options.
I don't think it's supposed to be a particularly strong free agent class.
No.
And also, like, if he does get hot with the new team, like, I think he'd be, you know, in terms of like projecting him going forward, they'd be like, wow, his tools are nuts and he's pretty young. Like, why was this us lying around? If like he has any measure of success at all, I feel like it looks great from a scouting and like projecting him forward standpoint. So like if he has like a monster playoffs or somebody, I feel like they'd be like, oh, 20 and it's not even like a long-term commitment. Like for a guy who's been mercurial, why not? So yeah, I think it depends on the pockets, but certainly not these pockets.
No. Certainly not the White Sox. The Chicago White Sox stay at home. They'll start this Memorial Day weekend, Friday through Sunday, at home against the Texas Rangers. On Monday, on Memorial Day, the White Sox will be in Queens against the New York Mets. The Rangers this year, 25-26. They're third place in the American League West. They're 4.5 games back of Seattle for first place. The Rangers are on a slump. They have lost their last four games, hoping to snap that losing streak against the White Sox. In their last 10, the Rangers are 5-5. What's working against the Rangers, they are not good on the road. They are 8-16 this year on the road. And their offense, for somewhat of a reason, is just not performing well. They have a team OPS of 655. That's 27th in Major League Baseball. They've only hit 54 homers. That's also 27th in Major League Baseball. They do have 45 stolen bases, which puts them in the top 10. But we're talking about a bottom five offense from the Texas Rangers, which is eye-opening. On the pitching side, though, speaking of eye-opening, their starters have a ERA of 2.84. That is the second best in Major League Baseball. The bullpen, their ERA is 3.97, which puts them more in the middle of the road, 16th in Major League Baseball. So the starters for the Rangers have really picked up their game and performing quite well for them. And we'll see one of them on Friday night. This game, first pitch is at 6:40 p.m. Central Time. Tyler Mahle, 1.47 ERA. Not sure where this came from. Again, Sean Burke for the White Sox on Saturday. This is a 3:10 p.m. Central Time start. Our friends, the Chicago Sports Bums, are hosting a tailgate in Lot B. So if you want to hang out and party with other White Sox fans, maybe even get a chance to see John Schifrin as he steps outside of the broadcasting booth and hangs out with White Sox fans in Lot B, you can do so. That tailgate will start around 1 o'clock. Again, that's in Lot B. Jack Leiter for the Rangers against Jonathan Cannon. And on Sunday at 1:10 p.m. Central Time, Patrick Corbin with his 3.59 ERA this year against the dart, Davis Martin. But with this series, as I mentioned in the intro, this is the old friend series. Will Venable gets a chance to manage against his former team. And Jake Berger returns to Chicago. And Berger has had quite the month of May. On May 1st, he was optioned, but then he returned to the Rangers on May 12th. And in the month of May, since returning, he's hitting .308 with a .341 on base percentage and slugging .590. So Berger, whatever worked when he got optioned for that brief moment down at AAA, worked on some things, has been hitting a lot better since he's rejoined the Texas Rangers. And it is a question that's been swirling in my head, Jim. The Jake Berger trade did not go well, was curious on how it was executed in the first place, probably got Kenny Williams fired for how he handled that particular trade. Do the White Sox regret trading Jake Berger, Jim?
That particular trade, yes. Trading Berger at all, probably not. The season that he's having right now is like a very extreme version of like what Jake Berger always does, which is like look lost for weeks and then look like the most dangerous hitter in baseball for weeks. Like he did that with the Marlins. He did that with the White Sox. He's doing that now with the Rangers. Got optioned down at the start of the month and then came back as on a tear. And like it all averages out to like low OBP, high slugging, yeah, like an insane ISO, and that's kind of what he gives you. And so Yeah, though I think the White Sox probably would have liked to see somebody have some staying power that they got for him, and Eater was not it, and not really close to his scouting report. So that, I think that's what's regrettable. Had they traded him for somebody who's, like a Shane Smith type, in terms of just somebody who, if Jake Eater turned into Shane Smith, like a credible member of your rotation, then nobody would be missing Jake Berg. People would miss him, or like look back at it fondly and say, like, I wish well for the guy. But in terms of value going forward, I think they probably feel better about what the pitcher is delivering for their team than Berger, who is a corner masher who often doesn't mash.
James, have you ever heard any whispers within the White Sox hallways about the Jake Berger trade? Have they regretted making that deal?
Yes. I mean, it was one person who would made the deal, so everyone else had a position to snipe about it. But yeah, I think there are lots of people in the White Sox who didn't like it. One from just like a talent perspective that seemed like kind of a rogue evaluation. And there were some people, like scouts I talked to, who liked Eater, but that was more about what he looked like pre-TJ and the assumption that he would get back to it. But like his stuff backed up and it never really like returned to the same level, on top of the command issues. He's kind of a guy who was commanding all of a sudden right before he got hurt, and then he went back to like not commanding, and then kind of looking like, hey, he's kind of only commanded for like a 3 month span in his whole career. Maybe we don't have anything worth expecting as far as regressing to a starter level of command. So yeah, I think it was both on the level of this return wasn't good. This was worked out between like two people who knew each other for a same time, and wasn't really, and kind of representative of like just not involving like the whole might of the whole organization,
It was like an
which,
old winter meetings type deal. Like
yeah, like,
1 a.m. in the hotel lobby. We're on our fourth bourbon. Let's get it done.
the thing they would say now, like for even like saying like why we're happy, we acknowledge that the Crochet trade was probably a better process than the Cease trade was. There's all this more people involved, all this like data that went into it, and research, and involving their R&D team and whatnot. And that's not obviously the process with this trade, and that's why everyone's kind of has a grievance about it. But also, like, Jake Berger wanted to be here. Like, he kind of said like he's so happy to be with the Marlins like within a week of the trade. But like, as far as like someone who was keeping the clubhouse like upbeat, who was happy to be like the face of the team, happy to be in social media stuff, happy to interface with fans, someone who had like a kind of a long relationship with the fan base because they saw him go through like his struggles and work all the way back. I think a lot of people, given that like it might be somewhat inevitable that he would gotten torn down at some or traded off at some point in this, because it's a little hard to project him to God, whatever the end date for what they're currently doing is. But it's probably a little premature for him to go at that window. I think he could have probably been someone who stabilized the 2024 offense a little bit, or he envisioned that, but like wasn't someone who was going to be like pouting or like get me the hell out of here like type of veterans like other people who got shipped out of the 2023
Whispering to Bob
deadline.
Nightingale.
Yeah, like he was someone who identified with the team in a way that wasn't like, once they stopped being a contender, he wanted off the boat. So I think a lot of people all over the organization are unhappy with just simply Berger going out, and that he did seemingly not for some like a deal that really respected his value in a major way. And I think the general view of trades that fan bases have can often be like a little over the top, where they both want a good player back, but like have somehow, set the return to self-destruct within 3 months of like arriving with a new team. Like every trade partner is actually a victim. I think that mentality goes so far, and like trades get evaluated like, did you get back what you intended? And the fact that they got basically 0 out of 10 for what they wanted, like a guy who like really only pitched in the majors because they wanted to see what it looked like rather than earned his way there with performance, I think it only drills home further. Like, yeah, Berger had his struggles, but he was fun. We liked him here. He provided enjoyment, and you swapped it out for this project that so authoritatively didn't click at any point that it's hard to ever really understand what you were going for, even if there was prospect pedigree there.
Can I throw an idea out there? Maybe something to ponder about, podcast listeners, for your upcoming off-season plan projects this off-season. Berger is going to turn 30, but he's finally going to be hitting arbitration next season, arbitration one. So, still not expensive, but he's going to make a lot more than a $790,000 salary this year, maybe $1 million or two. Let's say we're right and the White Sox do non-tender Andrew Vaughn. And let's say hypothetically, Tim Elko doesn't get any better and the White Sox don't have a lot of confidence in Elko being the everyday first baseman going into the 2026 season. Would you contemplate the idea if you were advising the White Sox, Jim, of calling the Texas Rangers and trading for Jake Berger since he's still got 3 years of arbitration and he's not going to be worth a whole lot in a trade because he's a first base DH type, but you do need a lot more power in your lineup.
I wouldn't like make a point to go and do it, but it would be a situation where like if you have absolutely nobody at first base and the Rangers are like, "Hey, this guy is not in our plans,"
Right.
then sure, inquire about it. Say like, "What do you need? Do we have anything that we can that we're not using that we can perhaps be mutually agreeable partners here on a smaller deal?" But yeah, in terms of like going out to try to bring him back, that almost seems like a little bit desperate. Like trying to
But
get
we are
a,
talking about the Chicago White
yeah. But in
Sox.
terms of like in also in a way that,
Why are you so obsessed with him?
it would be a case of like, it reminded me like when James McCann became a free agent and just, White Sox need to somehow sign him. Like, nah, just appreciate the time that was had versus try to recapture it. Like Elvis Andrus, same thing. When they brought him back, they probably brought to mind the idea like, oh, I think the White Sox got the best possible stint they could have ever gotten from Elvis
Yeah,
Andrus.
dead
Do you want
cat
to be
bounce.
relying on him? And like, yeah, just it fell apart. So I think like to bring back Berger with expectations, I think would be a little bit misplaced and not fits. But sometimes it happens in the sense that like the Rangers, I think, are going through a little bit of a lineup flux in terms of just who's clicking and who isn't. And so, players could be shuffled out. And it's a case where, yeah, I mean, Berger's still a credible power bat and, does have those heaters to where like he can be in anybody's lineup. So, he shouldn't like not interest the White Sox. It's just a matter of like a 30-year-old first baseman, with 3 years of team control left. But, limited places for him to go, should the athleticism decline. Be a case where like it's maybe not the timing was there. It's like movie relationships, like I didn't appreciate what we had. Like, well, the ship has sailed. I'm moving to another city. You can't chase this outcome. And that's kind of what strikes me as here.
Need cheap power, James. That's what the White Sox need. They need to find guys who are cheap and have the potential to hit more than 20 home runs. Options are very limited in that regard.
I think people pay like charge for home runs is the whole issue.
Well, yeah. That's what I'm saying, though.
Usually, for your
Someone's
power to
got
be cheap, you're
to.
doing something very objectionable that has to be coupled with it, like dropping one out of every three balls thrown at you, sort of thing.
Yeah. Maybe we can live with that. I don't
Moving
know.
with great discomfort and slow pace, stuff like that.
Yeah, well,
Horrible social
again.
media posts.
Yeah. Well, that's not Jake, though. Jake's not like that. Yeah. Just thinking of ideas, throwing things at the wall. Never mind. James hates my idea. Don't include in your off-season plans, podcast listeners. You don't want James to shoot that idea down in late October, early November. Forget it. We'll just have to find the next Daniel Palka somewhere else. Because that's all the White Sox can afford these days until they
It's
figure
like all
out how
those
to.
folk tales where you bring like a loved one back from the dead, but then like it's not right because they don't belong. They're supposed to be in the afterlife, and you unnaturally brought them back to the mortal coil. That's like signing a 30-year-old first baseman. I refuse to like.
Well, damn it, Carlos Santana keeps getting contracts and he's going to be playing until he's like 45, so.
Do like that Palka Berger. Like the White Sox have a lineage of friendly lummixes. that
They
I think
do.
they need to extend with a fresh face here. But I do like the 108 type build and demeanor, I think is you
Is
got to keep growing that tree.
Paul
yeah,
goes
well,
who I was thinking of when we were talking about like Palacios the other day of like he does everything like kind of just the same level of below average, so the manager feels comfortable kind of throwing him into situations, whereas like it's a different shape of like a 40 outfielder as opposed to somebody who's got like 70 grade power like Palka and like will have like the most fun games of all time, and like look up his defensive war and be like, oh, he's actually like underwater for the season, but we've had fun when he's cooking, so I don't know, who cares?
it's the fun
We
bad.
also
Like
lost
that's
that game where there was just a pop up to right field, but he takes them, you lose them.
yeah. Palka is fun bad. Palacios is not fun bad.
Right.
Yeah,
It's
that's
just,
fair. Jake Berger could be fun bad. yeah,
That's
definitely.
where we're at. We're searching. We're grasping for straws. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. We will be recapping and how the White Sox and the Rangers fare, especially Jake Berger returning. Be interesting to hear from Will Venable and how he feels managing against the Texas Rangers. And again, we get a chance to see some excellent starting pitching from the Rangers this weekend before the White Sox head to Queens for Memorial Day weekend. We hope that you have a wonderful, wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Get a chance to spend it with some friends and family. Hopefully, the weather gets a little bit warmer in Chicago so we can all enjoy it outside. And maybe I'll see some of you at the ballpark this weekend. But if you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at Sox Machine underscore Josh. We are on Blue Sky. You can follow us at SoxMachine.com. James is at jrfegan.soxmachine.com. I'm at josh.soxmachine.com. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, the White Sox minor league systems, the upcoming 2025 Major League Baseball draft, as I just posted our recent top 100 update for the upcoming draft, sign up at soxmachine.com. Monthly subscriptions start at $5. That gets you an ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. We also have additional tiers of support leading all the way up to our Veterans Committee, which will be part of our group chat with our other VCs, having direct access to both Jim and James during the season. If you're interested in that, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.